I am not in the academic world, and I work for the Bartlett Tree Research Laboratories, and our research group there does a lot of really applied research on management of trees and shrubs. We don't mess with turf grass at all, thankfully. And we also serve as basically traveling sort of consultants, advisors for the arborists across our company. And so that's where I'm coming from today is more observational stuff. So I'm based in California, but I cover British Columbia through Arizona. And what we're seeing right now in the Northwest is something I'm going to focus on, because I think in the Northwest we're seeing the impacts of climate changing a little bit more than in some other areas of the country. So basically I'm just going to talk about the fact that, you know, we really focus a lot on newly introduced invasive organisms when it comes to saving trees and shrubs. You know, there's always a new one coming or that just came. How many of you are familiar with the spotted lanternfly? That's like the big one that everyone's talking about in the East. You know, we'll see where it moves. But what we're really seeing a lot, especially on the West Coast, is pests, whether they be diseases or insects, that are typically thought of as secondary or not aggressive or very virulent, that are causing a lot of problems now on plants that used to perform very well. One of the poster children for that is the incense cedar, Calocedrus. Is there anyone familiar with that species? So it's native to California, but it's not native to all of California, and it's native to pretty high elevations. And so one of the primary things that we see is it's planted either at the edges or well outside its actual native range, and it just is stressed out. It's whether it's production practices, planting, poor root systems, you know, wrong depth, bad irrigation systems that were never updated as the tree grows. We see all kinds of things that lead to stress and challenging sites. But we don't. We also see a lot of pests showing up on these trees where they look pretty well maintained and well planted, well produced. So you know, we're seeing a lot of increases in native pests, and I'm going to talk specifically about one. But generally speaking, it's boar insects and canker pathogens are the ones that we're really seeing an uptick due to climate in many cases. So, talking about native trees, I'll talk about native pests because you sort of know where they are and where they've moved. But there's nothing native to the urban landscape. You know, there's no such thing as a native plant to downtown San Francisco. You know, there were trees that used to be there before there were roads there. But there's nothing that grew up and evolved in a parking lot, right? So I don't really get into whether a plant is native or not. I get into whether it's invasive or not, and that's way more important to me. But, you know, that's if I say native, that's kind of what I mean, is that none of them are native. But so this is one in particular. This is a beautiful little flat-headed borer that is wreaking havoc throughout the Pacific Northwest. We've been seeing this mainly on Thua species, so the arborvitaes that are planted, but what's scary to me is we're also seeing them on a lot of western red cedar, which is a native climax species throughout the Northwest. And we're seeing it, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when you have these stress-related problems in the landscape, it's not surprising because landscapes are stressful, just generally speaking, for plants. But when we're seeing them both in landscapes and in native stands in the forest, that's where, to me, it gets a little more concerning. So this is just a specific example I'll talk about. If you live in the Northwest, keep an eye out for it. It's killing plants and Northern California as well. But I think it serves as a good example of a pest that's native to North America, to Western North America, that never really got much attention over the last 100 years. But now it's starting to catch people's eyes as it all of a sudden is starting to kill a lot of horticultural plants, within one group. So the only literature I could find about this pest is from forestry. It's a minor pest of wood products in British Columbia. That's the only reports I could find were from British Columbia dating back to the 19-teens. You find it casually mentioned, but there's no research or anything done on it. So there's not a lot of information out there available, but it's a flathead borer, typical D-shaped exit holes. You know, the larvae all pretty much look the same. And we're seeing, again, a lot of both landscape and natural Thua species. So, this is not a Thua species. This is Monterey cypress. But what we saw a lot is this type of thing. These Monterey cypress were planted as a privacy screen. And a lot of the lower branches started dying back. And so the landscaper decided to mangle all the shrubs underneath with the hopes of increasing airflow and sunlight to reduce canker diseases. But the branches continued to die, and so they were just pruning them off as they died. Now, that's not serving its function anymore, right? It was a privacy hedge. It's not providing any privacy anymore. But that's the kind of thing we see, is that these lower branches are dying back. People just attribute it to cankers, when it's actually this pest. So what happens is they lay their eggs on the lower branches, and then the larvae tunnels into the lower branches and goes pretty much straight to the trunk of the tree. And any individual plant, and these are, you know, this is probably a 6-inch cut right there. This is an inch. And so they're various size branches that are being attacked. They get into the bole of the tree, and it's not a given branch dying back that's killing the tree. It's when you have multiple branches, because they stay pretty much right at the branch collar, and then they emerge from there. And so it's when you have multiple branches all around the trunk of the tree. And it's always under what we used to think, it was always stress trees. So if you give them a little better irrigation, mulch, do the kinds of things we do to keep plants growing vigorously, it shouldn't be a problem. But we're seeing them on landscapes where it shouldn't be a problem. So this is sort of just the typical backyard in Portland, where you start to see lower branches sort of scattered, dying back, and eventually it gets to the point of girdling and the whole tree dies. And again, this could be, you know, I've had arborists tell me for certain that this is Phytophthora root rot. They've told me for certain it was Ceridium canker. They've told me that is undoubtedly the native cedar bark beetle. And it's not until we started pulling out hundreds of these flat-headed borers that we're pretty convinced that's what it is. And it's happening in young trees. And this is where I think it connects to climate change. We're seeing it in natural stands where there are old western red cedars that have done very, very well, large trees, 200-300-400-year-old trees that are still there. But then we have the next generation of trees are all getting killed by this pest. So it wasn't a bad site for these pests, but now it is. And so again, what you see is just scattered lower branch dieback, and then eventually it kills the tree. These pictures I took, and this was a very big concern, we were called in to consult with the Seattle Parks Department, because they're losing trees in a lot of their sort of, if you've ever been to Seattle, a lot of their city parks are very natural settings. They're not really highly maintained parks like in the Olmsted vein of things. They're just forest swatches, basically. So yeah, we're seeing young trees dying where mature trees have performed very, very well, the same species, where they're native to the region, and so is this pest. And we're seeing it mostly on south-facing slopes, the upper areas of slopes, higher areas, more well-drained soils. And so that's where we believe that it's coming into the climate change thing, because in California, you know, we had 10 years of drought and we're still seeing effects of that, whereas in the Pacific Northwest, they're under a drought technically right now, but really it's just long-term, hotter, longer, drier summers, except for this year, right? Yeah. It's been cold up there this year. Anyway. So, you know, I'm not going to dive too deep into the diseases because that would take too long, because I actually am a pathologist, not an entomologist, but we're seeing a lot of Botrytisferia relatives, that group, killing trees and not just causing branch dieback, but actually killing trees. A lot of the Ceridiums and that group of pathogens, these are all pretty much Ascomycetes, but and then the Hypoxylon and those relatives are all things that you see on senescent trees, but we're seeing them under conditions that they shouldn't be stress-related. But and we think it's because of the change in climate, not individual stress factors. So I kind of talked about that. So what can we do other than water more? You know, we're talking about mitigation. And one of the things Lloyd mentioned, well, I should back up and say, whether you're talking about stress reduction or disease and insect management, the plant selection in the first place is obviously the most important thing. I don't usually get to choose plants. I'm brought in after the plants are already dying, right? The joke is that we're dentists, we're not doctors, because you go to the doctor regularly, but you only go to the dentist when there's a problem, right? So we get called when there's a problem. But then, you know, all the kind of planting things that just maximize the vigor of the plant are going to help reduce any stresses related to climate. You know, depth and burlap are the two killers that I see a lot, especially on hedges. You know, there's a lot of things you can do with the soil. So one of the things Lloyd mentioned is we're looking at a couple different soil applications for existing trees. And what we found is that the potassium-based product looked really, really good in keeping river birch really looking good in the face of drought stress. And we're also seeing some good results with calcium additives to soil. Now, you got to be careful with these fertilizer products because some of them are salts in and of themselves, but you can get some that are pretty low salt index. Another thing that I'm looking at right now, which the governor called off the drought in California, kind of screwed me, but is plant growth regulators. So we're looking at the ability of type 2 growth regulators, gibberellic acid inhibitors, to increase drought resistance. So we all know, I mean, it's been, I don't know if we all know, a lot of people, whether you're in nurseries or greenhouses or out in the landscape, plant growth regulators have been used a lot, basically to manage the size of plants. But, you know, and we know all about that. There's dozens of years of research with that kind of stuff. But we're just starting to look right now at the stress-reducing properties. So this is a plot I have in it's central California, just outside Santa Barbara area, if you're familiar with Lompoc, then I'm sorry. But and we've planted dozens of different shrub species, hundreds of plants. This is only about a fifth of the plot. And it's on really well-drained sandy soils, so we thought we were going to be able to really manipulate drought stress. And then the governor called off the drought, and now we don't have any drought stress in that plot. But the first year data looked really good, and then it started raining a couple years ago. So that was tough. But why would this work? All right. And the reason, sort of the logic, is sort of evolutionarily when you look at, so these are two species within the red oak group. All right. So we have red oak, and then we have the coast live oak, the California coast live oak. And they're both within the erythroblanus group. So they're relatively closely related. But they're way different in morphology. And so the differences here are you have smaller leaves. On the more drought-adapted coast live oak, you have smaller leaves. They're thicker. They also have, you know, they have just more layers of cells of parenchyma. They're much hairier. They're much more pubescent around the stomata especially. And they have a thicker cuticle. So these are all drought adaptations, right? Plants that are typically growing naturally have these types of features compared to wet areas. And so what do we see with type 2 growth regulators? Plants produce the same number of cells. It doesn't affect mitosis. It affects cell elongation. So when plants have been treated with a type 2 growth regulator, they're just not expanding as much. They're still growing the same number of cells. And you see it. You see smaller leaves. You see thicker leaves. These photos came from a colleague of mine at Rainbow who sells a lot of paclobutrazol, but you have thicker leaves, you know, and actually he got them from a professor at Purdue. Sorry, I should have put that up there. You see hairier leaves, and just generally speaking, what you're basically doing over the course of 2 to 3 seasons is morphologically changing what these plants would adapt to over, you know, millions of years. And so, you know, it's not the most natural thing in the world. You know, it's not organic label on these things, but it certainly works well. We've seen it in a lot of field situations, and right now we've got a bunch of plots across North America looking at it in a more controlled setting. So that's something that we're pretty excited about, and I think is, at least when you haven't been involved in the step of selecting what plants should be there in the first place, and you have to come in and try and mitigate some drought stress afterwards, this looks like a pretty valuable tool. But it's not, you know, it's not going to be a silver bullet. It's got to be taken in context with everything else. All right, so just to wrap things up, borer insects and canker fungi, I see them every single day across the West Coast on the uptick just because of, you know, it's weather, but it's probably climate. And the idea that native plants are tougher just does not apply whatsoever. For one thing, because nothing's native to the urban landscape. And number two, whatever they were native to historically over eons is changing. And so it's not native to that. Like Agar was talking about, you know, you got to look south for what the conditions are going to be like. And again, PGRs, they're not going to be a silver bullet, but the growth regulators seem to be looking pretty good in not just regulating growth, but also in inducing a bit of stress resistance in these trees. So that's what I'm going to talk about, or did talk about.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. See you guys over there. Great. So this is a workshop, our sponsored workshop. So we have allotted time to talk with you. I see landscape professionals out there, urban foresters. What are you guys seeing? Did anything come up with landscape ET with Janet? My calls for action or mitigation strategies? Drew's warning of the future of bugs? and Igor's idea where you can look for places. Yes, ma'am.
The number one thing that comes to mind would be to provide a play surface for sports for youth and adults that's safe and doesn't result in injuries.
So in your mind, the landscape is
wrong? No, I disagree. I think that in a landscape, warm season grass, and what I tried to indicate, up to 20 or 25% of a landscape planted in warm season grass, as long as the distribution uniformity is where it needs to be, is just as water conserving as most of the other plants.
Yeah, and the reason I ask this question is because I'm Reno, and what a lot of people have done is replace the turf grass with rock.
Right.
It's very, very hot. To me, seems like we're kind of making our cities hotter.
Yes. Very much so. Right. And that's a function as well, cooling. In California, it will keep you within that 0.45 to 0.55 ETAF to be in the lowest water tier. If we're just looking at the physiology and the cooling factor, then you could have a whole backyard of turf, and if it were irrigated efficiently, I would argue that ecologically that's not a bad thing. So, yeah, does that make sense? Okay. And these are just my thoughts based on a body of research, but that's a great question, and this is a discussion. Any other comments on turf while we're on that topic? Not you, Igor.
Close to the microphone.
Any other feeling? Turf, lawn, any of the four-letter words, turf or lawn, do have a negative connotation these days, and so there is a positive side, and certainly over a xeriscape, Of rock or nothing.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of turf.
Yeah.
But I do see whether it can be a benefit if properly irrigated,
right,
properly placed.
Right.
Overspray onto areas and a lot of evaporation. So yeah. I guess that's, I'm just trying to, in my mind, as a professional, trying to find
that
balance.
Right.
Try to teach that. Can I go with a not opposing view, but I think you're going to, what Janet really pointed out in her presentation is that all of this depends on that turf being irrigated pretty much perfectly, mm-hmm. which is when you have a tiny strip of turf next to someone's house, that, and of course that someone insists on using sprinklers because I don't want to mess with the hose, that's not going to happen. It's not going to be irrigated perfectly. You will absolutely waste water, and I think in the long run, and I'd love to hear from people from more desert regions, I think we will lose the argument. So it's, and I'm certainly a person who would absolutely defend the use of turf in playing fields and in these areas where it can be managed properly. For residential landscapes, the chance of that happening is very, very, very low. And so then the question is, if you're just shooting for shading cooling type effect, and there was a recent study by Stephanie Pinsettle and all of those folks from UCLA who hate turf. But they showed that in a mixed turf tree landscape, the water used by trees is very low. The water used by turf typically can be greatly reduced simply because the turf is overwatered. And that if you really want those shading cooling benefits, you would keep the trees and you would do away with the turf. I don't like that prescription simply because that typically means removing all irrigation and the trees die, exactly as Jen described it. But I think for residential landscapes where the turf is basically just looked at, I think we're going to have a very difficult time justifying the turf. That's sort of...
One comment on that, it also gets back to the sprinkler irrigation efficiency or distribution uniformity. So whether it's a ground cover or turf, any large crop-like area, then obviously what comes into play is having to irrigate very efficiently.
Well, the ground covers, you can irrigate them really well with drip.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do that drip.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
I was just curious, so on the kind of substitution space for time method, and then also talking about kind of the emerging pathogens and plant selection being really important, some of my work and a lot of my personal interest is in native plants that are native to the region, if not to a particular landscape. And it seems like a lot of the bottleneck in that is in the supply chain, that there's just not a lot available of what you would hope for the next 50 years, or you know, what takes a lot less water right now even. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on where you've seen the bottleneck in that chain or possible solutions for getting the right types of plants in.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I can make a list 100 species long that are great for an arid climate, and if you can't go buy them, then it doesn't matter what that list says. And I don't know, you know, there's things that we've been talking about generations before me in this industry that still happen. So it's hard. You know, I think there's got to be both push and pull, where the producers need to understand that they can maybe charge a higher premium for plants that are a little more rare, and then the consumers need to demand it as well. But you know, I'm in the public outreach realm, I don't do much of, so I don't know how the mechanics, you know, how that would work, but I go to a lot of nurseries, tree growers, and if you've never heard of that species, you're not likely to go down to Home Depot and buy it, whereas if you are seeking out a specialty grower, then you're more likely the kind of person who's going to use those.
I would just add that one way, when it comes to trees, that has been reasonably successful is to have them contract grown, right, for a municipality or another public entity to commit, pay, and then essentially order those trees in advance. Depending on your municipal budget setup, that may be close to impossible when you have to sort of pay for something multiple years in advance kind of thing. But that works very well in part because, and this was Eric North from which university? I forget. Yeah, he's in the Midwest. But he pointed out that people will seek out what they see elsewhere, right? What they see on the street, what they see their neighbors planting. So if, as a municipality, you can drive that diversification, that's a fantastic kind of thing to do when all of a sudden you get civilians interested in, well, what is that tree? Well, it's a new oak, you know, Mexican net leaf oak or something like that. But the actual mechanics of doing it are a little problematic. Yeah.
Can I follow up? Yeah, so you might, following up on that in particular, do you think that going to a municipality would be more effective than trying to hit some of the larger landscaping companies and be like, you guys need to shift your installer into your parking complexes? Do you think one is better than the other?
I think a municipality can require, or a county or any kind of authority can require low water use plants, can acquire climatically appropriate plants. Native, I think longer discussion, happy to have it over later in the day over adult beverages. But my caveat would just be that in a lot of places there's just not that many native, especially trees, right? We'd end up with like a urban forest of two species. Not the recipe for success. And what Drew said really resonates with me. Nothing is native to most of our cities. It's not that nothing was native there before there were cities. It's just that we have to manage what we have now. And, you know, this is... Anyway, longer discussion. But I would argue it's both, right? You're trying to push the landscape architecture side of things, but you're also saying to the municipality, look, don't just walk away. Don't just sign off on a plan review when somebody's putting in 500 London planes. Like, ask them whether this is climatically appropriate, not just for today, but for a reasonably predicted 50 years from today. Like, that's totally reasonable. And developers, frankly, don't care, at least in my experience. You want monkey, what is the monkey, Pentandra, monkey paw, or whatever it's called. Yep, sure, no problem. And they will make it happen, especially when you have $5 million houses coming in, right?
And CalFlora, are you familiar with CalFlora? That site is trying to, you know, if you will, cut through the red tape of, you know, you're darned if you do and darned if you don't, because nurseries won't carry it, because no one's asking because nurseries. So they do connect. They have a section on their searchable database that you can connect nurseries that are currently.
Oh, yeah,
carrying.
I have seen that part.
Yeah. That helps a little bit.
Also I see the womb people are in the room. So, hey, John. A question in the back, and we'll get one more. So two more questions.
Yeah, so Eric North is from University of Minnesota.
There we go. Go Gophers.
But one of the things we've run into, too, up in the northern states is that not only are we looking at heat temperatures for selecting, but also wintertime temperatures, and not just daytime temperatures, but our nighttime temperatures are warming up as well. So it's almost, you know, there's almost even more facets to look at than just, you know, looking for the heat.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, I've been dealing a lot lately with boxwood blight, and in California, there are dozens of species that you can treat exactly like boxwoods, if you're into that kind of thing. And they look the same, they take shearing, they're going to use the same function, but you start talking about that where we actually find boxwood blight on the West Coast, in Vancouver, in, you know, British Columbia, and these northern states, and they're not going to make it through the winter, even though they'd be great for the Bay Area. So yeah, you know, it's a lot of times, I think Iyer mentioned it, like where you typically think of it being super hot, it also could be super cold, and it's got to go both extremes.
Let's go one more. She had her hand up a little earlier, but I see you both. Yeah, you did. Yeah.
So this is kind of piggybacking on what you were saying, and this is for your space-time modeling. You were talking a lot about finding something that is corresponding heat, but along the Front Range, especially the northern Front Range of Colorado, what we have are now, we have much, much longer, higher temperatures into the fall. Trees are not going dormant. We're getting these sudden freeze events, so we're getting a lot of cambium kill and that sort of thing. And then in February, we're getting these warm-ups causing a great dormancy early. So how does that sort of thing plug into your model, which I think is really cool, but how do you start looking for corresponding areas with such wacky roller coaster type stuff
that
started going on?
I think you use your best professional judgment and see if you can find an analogous location. You may not be able to. But if you start thinking about it, you can kind of reach out to other professionals in other areas and say, does this make sense? You know, here's what we have. Here's the kind of climate we are having and the kind of climate we're getting. How does that compare to yours?
Great job.
does it? Yeah, no, seriously. No, but seriously, right? I think that is what you kind of have to do. Is it going to work for everywhere? No, because at some point you really reach so far away that the sources of trees are different, and your colleague may not know. Like, I don't know if this will grow here because we've never tried it, right? So at some point it kind of falls apart. But I still think it's better than kind of saying, well, we'll plant whatever we've planted. It works fine, right? That's not really a sustainable strategy. So, but you're right. There will be many, many situations where this results in some grinding of the gears and not a perfect fit. No, you're absolutely right.
All right, so I'm going to actually terminate this, because there is another session scheduled here at 3:30. But for those who are not in the water, first of all, stay for the water utilization and management group and join if you're interested in this type of thing and become active in your society. And chair-elect. And secondly, thank you for being here and participating. I think you three are not staying, so you could catch up with them in the hallway if you can. Is that all right? Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Safe travels.
See you guys.
See you, Lord.
Do you want to join? You want to stay? Hey, John?
Talk about where we go from here.
Yeah. Catch up with you guys after this? I'll leave pretty soon. Yeah, where are you going? All right, I'll see you back. It was good. Come up to the North Bus.
John,
let's sit up here.
Yes, you do.
Okay, that sounds good, Drew.
Are you leaving this meeting?
No, I don't need to. I think you're the chair.
No, Mandy's the chair.
Are you?
Aren't I the past chair?
I don't even know. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to be up here.
That's what I thought. But then I got, like, promoted too rapidly. So we need some new officers.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're leading it. I'll lead it.
So Mandy asked me to lead it.
Oh, good. Perfect. So you're leading it.
Since you're here.
Come on. It's not too hard to lead, although I haven't prepped for it. Okay, so now we're going to do the water utilization management.
You like that microphone, don't you?
Yeah, it's here. Meeting. And this is John, and I'm Lloyd, and Mandy's not here. Mandy's our chair.
I was going to introduce myself as Mandy, but now I can't do that.
And this is, yeah. And so here we go. Did you bring a sign-in sheet?
I have paper.
Great. We'll pass that around. Yep.
All right. So this is water utilization and management business meeting. And I am not Mandy, nor do I really think that I'm on the board, but she asked me to do this, so I'm being nice. So do we want to elect people first? Because I think we need to elect
two
people.
Yeah, we do need to elect people.
Is my understanding. So because things kind of got weird. And that they thought I was still on the board as part of the committee, but then I wasn't. And so anyway, as far as I know, Mandy's rotating off. She's the chair. Lloyd is the incoming chair, so he'll
chair-elect,
be chair
yep.
next year. Yeah, that's right. Thank you, chair-elect. So we need to elect a chair-elect for next year as well as a secretary. So if you come in as chair-elect, it means that you don't have to take any notes. Just saying. But if you come in as secretary, the way that it typically works is you go secretary, and then you go to chair-elect, and then chair, and then they kind of have some, like post-chair, and you can kind of help the group out if they need it. So do we have any volunteers for either of those positions? Okay.
Hey, Scott.
I'm Scott Lucas from Organization
yeah.
University also.
We can actually do introductions first. And so I'm John Meister at Clemson University. My main area is in ornamental production. So I work mainly with irrigation and fertilization management. We can start here.
Frank Thompson, Iowa State University, primarily teaching landscape design, landscape construction, ornamental tools. Juanito Ferrizzi, University of Florida, Citrus Horticulture as the Intermediate Research and Education Center. Perfect.
Andrea De Silva, Assistant Professor of Vegetable Production at the University of Florida.
Perfect.
Lucas with Oregon State University at the Hermiston Ag Research Experiment Station. Assistant professor, and a lot of my work is focused on water use efficiency and irrigated horticulture crops.
Ramon Anacidia, horticulture specialist in Missouri, University of Missouri Extension.
Jake Trekas, USDA ARS in Worcester, Ohio.
Great. I'm Lloyd Nackley, assistant professor at Oregon State University in nursery production, and I focus on water and nutrient utilization efficiencies.
So we have one person for chair-elect. Do we have a second for that?
Oh, I second that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So any discussion? Any other candidates? All right, all those in favor? Any opposed? You can raise your hand if you want to, but it won't matter. All right, semi-unanimously. All right, and chair or secretary for the meeting in Orlando next year, so you get to do the great note-taking.
Great. Your name again?
Andre.
Andre. All right. I second.
All right. You want to throw your hat in the ring?
Oh, he does. Yeah.
You third it. All right. Any discussion? All those in favor? All right. Are you ready to post?
I guess the discussion would be, do you plan on going to Orlando next year?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And then I think Denver in 2021.
Oh, really?
Is what I heard. So you would be the chair in Denver. So.
Yes, I'll be
here. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Awesome. So ASHS keeps track of this stuff. So you guys will go on to the email list, and you'll get all those fun emails about, hey, you're the womb pig. Mm-hmm. So. Just be aware of that.
That's weird.
I know. It's not my acronym.
So, what we do also beyond that? Have you been involved in? Has anybody been involved in this one? A lot of new faces. It's low. Like there wasn't all that much this year. We planned the workshop that was just before this, as well as a tour that got canceled because of the heat. So those are things that we've engaged on. You get emails from the society. But I think there could be larger engagement because water cuts across so many production systems. And also it sounds like there's a number of assistant professors and early career faculty in the room, right? So we're looking forward to making like those national level connections. And John and I are in multi-state, so we have that. But those opportunities exist, and I think we could look at them. So I don't know where to take this. Like, are there any projects or questions? Like, what are people looking at right now in general? I'll start, just so there's some framework. So I work a lot with sensors, soil moisture sensors, and nursery production systems, but also interested in characterizing kind of deficit nutrient, in that relationship between water and nutrients. Is anybody else doing that too? It's pretty common.
Kind of so useful. I'm using a lot of sensors in my work, and I'm also trying to correlate soil profile moisture utilization with nitrate leaching, because they're clearly closely correlated. So similar type of work, but more in row crops.
Mm-hmm. Row crops, yeah.
I'm working with grapefruit at the moment, particularly to try to extend tree life using an improved enhanced nutrition in light of the citrus disease or citrus greening disease or HLB, and that primarily links to spoon feeding or increasing the number of application of nutrients per year. I link that with improved irrigation systems. And also fertigation. So the idea is to keep the trees alive till we find a cure for the disease using also a lot of other tools, soil moisture sensors, and changing cultural practices regarding protected environments. So we are trying to produce citrus indoors.
Hmm. Well, I have been working with sensors. Fine-tune irrigation scheduling. Most recently, soil water release curve. I have just recently acquired from my lab an hydroprop tube equipment. So we go in several cores where we're going to get samples all around the state, and we want to do pre-gauge. So if anybody want to collaborate with that, we can do some part of work in Southeast or South U.S., and we can map and add this information, and maybe collaborate with the USD and add this information for the web of soil. If we don't have this information available, with that we can assume what is the soil field capacity, permanent loading point, and saturation point, and then maybe it can be a part of a big grant, mostly grant.
Are you doing this in soils or soilless substrates?
No, I'm doing it in soils.
In soils, okay.
I contact the growers.
Yeah.
We go to different farms, and we are starting in Southwest Georgia, but we're going to do it for where the vegetable production is located.
Right.
So we go in several farms, we collect the soil cores, and then we bring it to our lab, and we start to do the analysis.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do cover crops in the wine grape, and so I look into the interaction or competition for the water and nutrients. We use all different kind of sensor, TDR or EM50 for the moisture. And also I'm using that SWIRT system, soil water retention system, at the time of establishment. So I have membranes and stuff installed like 50 centimeters under the wine row. And then I compare different deficit water treatments to see if those membranes are helping, especially in the very sandy soil, light texture soil. So I work in Summerland in British Columbia, Okanagan Valley, very sandy soils, usually dealing with, and it's a dry environment. So water is very important. All agriculture is irrigated.
And what was your name again, sir?
Mehta Shurifi. Last name is Shurifi.
Thank you.
My name is Kirk Pierce again.
Thanks.
My research is on pecan and alternate irrigation, and in that case, partially it's ongoing. And we're soil sensors. We're also using rhizosphere, mini rhizopods, to look at the rhizosphere and see if there's any root pattern change, and doing nutrient analysis to see if there's any additional mobilization of nutrients as a result of the alternate water.
Are you in the Southwest also?
New Mexico.
New Mexico, yeah. Great. Nice one, guys. Anybody else feel like sharing? Yeah, hey, Ping.
I mean, I've started.
Landscape. And you're at Utah State?
Yeah, Utah State.
Nice one.
So I've been getting into looking at irrigation efficiencies and trying to improve those as far as how those sprinkler heads are actually working themselves. So it's a project that we just started to get into, so we'll see how that goes. I mean, it sounds to me like, as far as I was thinking ahead to workshops or planned oral in Florida, and it seems like it might be as far as, you know, sensor networks or using new technologies to help with water, with answering questions related to water. I mean, seems like a pretty natural fit for what I've been hearing. Thoughts on that?
What about other stuff? So sometimes I wonder if that's like we went on that track because I mentioned that's what I did. Are there other people that are doing things differently and or opportunities that you've seen in the last year or two, you know, in landscape or, you know, where water utilization and management could be improved? Sure. Like row tunnels or?
No,
yeah.
But it's kind of the same concept.
Mm-hmm. Let me your name again and the university. Missouri.
I think
like lots of damages to our sensors. And now there are a lot of research on the wireless sensors, and probably soon they're going to be in the market. I'm not aware of anyone in the market now, but probably soon in a year or two. I know people
who not robust ones research. Anyway.
Yeah. What's that, sorry?
Not robust ones, ones that you'd actually put out in the field and assume that they're working correctly.
Yeah, so they're working on those,
right.
So testing those to see, and the cost probably going to reduce with those kind of sensors. Also, there are some of my colleagues doing research based on the irrigation scheduling, based on the temperature of the leaves, so putting sensors on the grape leaves, mm-hmm. and then based on the changes in the temperature, they can do the irrigation sort of money.
So, I mean, as far as 2020 in Orlando, what do we as a group, how do we feel about what we want to kind of put forward? Because I think if we don't kind of at least get some ideas down on paper here, typically it makes it a lot harder down the road.
Yeah, we send out emails and no one responds, or three of us respond, and then, we do what we thought. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm more than happy to have a discussion about that. I don't think that there's anything after this, but, I mean, technically we have another 5 minutes to discuss if somebody else shows up. So, I mean, is there anything that you guys think would be good for discussion in Orlando?
2 years ago, the multi-state group with the Lakeville 3128 had a tour at Disney World. There was a facility that Michael Dukes used for his turfgrass studies. It was quite interesting to go and visit if the tour is a possibility. And the same group went to Animal Kingdom to see how they control the irrigation, so they showed us the controllers, all the valves, so it was quite interesting and very close to the venue of the hotel.
Yeah. Which multi, did you say 3120?
It's Daywood 3128.
3128.
The micro irrigation research group.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say, I'm also in the nutrient management nursery crop working group.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that typically ASHS has a group going to Disney World. They did last time we were in Orlando. So they may not, I mean, depending on what we do, if we can kind of separate it enough from what they're doing, say doing the micro irrigation stuff, they may say, well, no, that kind of steps on our feet. You know, they obviously get veto power. So, I mean, it's a great idea, but I don't know. So the nursery work group also said going to a couple of propagators and nurseries in the area. And so that would be another thing if we wanted to group up with them. I mean, I'm more than happy to also mention that for other things that we would do as a tour for this group.
Somebody else.
I remember, I think it was in Miami, we saw it was an elder church scrubber, and that was really cool to see. A number of years ago, but I think it was with ASHS. So I think there's some stuff in the area. So
that's just technical, even though it's at the Disney resort area, the park area, so it's nothing to do with the behind the scenes or something like that. So you go really on the back door and see that. So it's not the same group that ASHS probably offers.
Right. I know. I just didn't want, as long as we can explain that to them and say, hey, we know you guys are doing behind the scenes support, but we didn't want to be qualified clients. We want to go into the next step. So, and say this is different. It's a kind of choose your own adventure kind of thing. So, but I mean, I think that's a great idea. Any other suggestions or things in the area that we could go see as a group? I mean, do we want to field the tour? That'll be fun.
Not with me. I do it this year. They just didn't like it.
That's right.
I will follow on Jake.
I think a tour would be.
Yeah, helpful. Tour would be fine.
I don't have any knowledge of Florida, so
yeah.
I don't have any great ideas to propose.
So I'm trying to think.
I like
Dr.
Perez.
Chris Marble. He's at the University of Florida. He was in the nursery group, and he
was more than happy to help kind of connect people to the things in the area for the nursery group. And I mean, so he would probably be a good contact. If you email me, I can get you in touch with him as a point of contact. So.
Also, you?
Just out of curiosity, how many of you are nursery and how many are field crop? Who's doing nursery work?
So not that many, but just the people up front. So that's, yeah, the people with the microphones. Yeah, yeah.
We've got bigger voices.
Yeah. But that's the neat thing about water, right? Is that it cuts across. So you were starting to say like a workshop, and is there a need? You've been doing sensors for longer than I have. Do you think that it would be, or you guys, do you think it would be valuable if we did a current state of sensors, or is that just people have done it too much? You think so? Yeah, and like the different ones, the leaf sensor. I've never worked with leaf sensors.
To be honest with you, I think the sensor technology is changing so quickly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the last time I know that anything with sensors and workshops I've been done is when Mark Van Aerosol and John Lee Cox put it together probably, what, 5 years ago now? And, I mean, the scene has changed quite a bit as far
right.
as IoT stuff goes. And so,
yeah.
I mean,
just create another state project and just create another group of sensors and work now.
Huh.
Yeah, they went to the UGA a month ago, and what they were doing.
Who is this?
I forgot the name of the tech company that they raised together when Mark was...
No.
It's a new company.
SensorWeb?
Yeah, it's
is it? Oh, yeah.
And then they came with these different sensors, but now for future.
Yeah.
So they started with the nurses.
Right.
And then they came there, and they presented it to us.
Okay.
And that was Van Aerosol's group?
No.
Or Lee Cox.
SensorWeb with Van Aerosol, and then
Carnegie Mellon is where that came out of the SensorWeb.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell you guys. David Kolbash. Thank you.
It would be nice if you could make it a hands-on work.
That's what I was thinking.
Equipment.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, wireless, multi-chain.
Yeah.
John Lee Cox wants to bring it to you, so. Talk, so.
4 o'clock. Also, meeting is officially timed up. So, just there it is. Got my moderator. Yeah, totally. Okay. Sensor web. Okay.
You got all the downloads?
I have pieces of it. Yeah.
Lovely to get the right piece.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think those are great. I think tours. So you were saying, Chris, but. And you, Raimento, I think, said he would help too. I don't know where is your station? Are you near Orlando or?
It's 1.5 hours south of Orlando.
Okay, so somewhat in the area, more than us Oregon people. So, great.
I would focus if you guys want to go to a nursery in the Apopka region, which is about 30 minutes north of Orlando, and so that's the nursery capital.
Huh. Oh, okay, good.
That's
so he knows that.
There's a lot of stuff in there, yeah. And it'll be more than glad to know. Yeah.
Okay, great, thank you.
Another thing to talk about in Florida is too much water, you know, having the water table like nutrients, and, you know, obviously, flooding is also a thing, too, so.
I mean, they could do, so we just did climate in water and landscapes, and we were doing drought and temp. I mean, Florida would be flooding, and seawater would rise. Like honestly, like that could be a theme. Is, you know, water management in, you know, change systems. So, yep.
Everglades.
Yep. Giant snakes.
Is there a tie between this group and the water utilization sessions, or is that completely separate?
So the water utilization management session. So this group could sponsor either a workshop, a water utilization management workshop, or we could sponsor a planned oral session for water utilization management. So, I mean, basically the way that the thinking of ASHS goes, the people that would be involved with the moving working group would also be presenting, not always, but, you know, generally the people that would be in the bloom sessions would be the people that are in the bloom team.
Let's go with For now, we'll go, let's go with the, we'll think about a sensor workshop and see where that takes us, and then we'll also think about a tour to an interesting and unique production area for irrigation, technical aspects. Sounds good?
Yep.
That's a productive business meeting then.
Thank you all for coming.
But you could say, if there's other things that we want to talk about, we can.
Send us an email.
Oh, send us an email. Okay, good. All right, thanks, guys. Great job.